This could have been a very different country if Abraham Lincoln had lived to serve out his second term as president, but the idea of a country binding up its wounds with malice toward none essentially died with Lincoln. Instead of Lincoln, the country got his vice president, Andrew Johnson, elevated to the top job. Johnson was a Southern Democrat and racist who had no intention of providing the full benefits of citizenship to former slaves, and that brought him into opposition with Congress, leading to the first ever impeachment of a president, just one Senate vote short of removal from office. Brenda Wineapple tells the story in her book, The Impeachers, The Trial of Andrew Johnson and the Dream of a Just Nation. Brenda Wineapple is a historian and writer, and a versatile writer at that. Her books include histories, biographies, and collections of poetry by other writers that she edited. Brenda's shorter work appears in the likes of The Nation and The Wall Street Journal. Brenda Wineapple, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
So, fascinating story, first ever impeachment. What drove you to write a book on it?
Well, I thought that I was a fairly literate, fairly intelligent person, fairly well educated, and I really knew nothing about it. And it occurred to me in my last book, Ecstatic Nation, which covered, you know, the same period before, during, and after the Civil War. And as I looked at that period, I thought, why is it that most of us seem not to know about this first ever presidential impeachment? Why has it, you know, fallen by the wayside? Why was it considered shameful and embarrassing? So I decided to dig in a little bit.
Did the public think then, as many people seem to now, that impeachment means you're removed from office, which it does not?
Right. The public did think that. And as Mark Twain, who was alive during the time of the impeachment and actually in Washington covering some of it, said, you know, nobody really knew what impeachment was. Nothing like that had ever happened in the country before. And so, you know, there were a lot of misconceptions. And to a certain extent, those misconceptions remain with us. Impeachment is something that the House votes on, and you need a majority in the House to impeach a president. But then there's a trial, and the trial is undertaken in the Senate, where you need two-thirds of the Senate to remove the impeached person from office. So it's a real two-pronged process.
Impeachment is essentially the indictment, then, and the jury trial takes place in the Senate.
Exactly, exactly. And that's a great way to think about it. But most of us, you know, didn't think about it that way because impeachment has such a ring to it.
It does indeed. Before we get to the transgressions of Andrew Johnson, how did a Democrat get onto Lincoln's ticket, Lincoln being the party of Lincoln guy, the creator of the Republicans?
Exactly. Well, you know, it was 1864. Lincoln was up for a second term. He certainly wanted to stay in office and prosecute the war, but he was actually afraid that he may not be reelected. He was running against George McClellan, who was a very popular general and a war Democrat, but a Democrat. And the war hadn't been going so well for the Union when Lincoln was thinking about the vice president, if indeed he was. There's some controversy about whether Lincoln actually chose him, but I think Lincoln, you know, knew what he was doing and had his fingers on the scales. So Andrew Johnson, who represented Tennessee in the Senate before the war, became the military governor of Tennessee. Lincoln had appointed him there because he had been so heroic before the war. He opposed secession, and he was the only United States senator from the South to do it. So Lincoln thought that would be a great way to balance the ticket. You'd have a Democrat and you'd have a Southerner, and it might increase his chances for reelection. Actually, he didn't need Johnson because there were some significant victories before the election, but nonetheless, that's what happened.
So for Andrew Johnson, how diametrically opposed were his views of the readmittance of Southern states and the establishment of black rights to those of congressional leaders?
Pretty well. They differed tremendously. But at first, after Lincoln was assassinated, and you have to realize, you know, that this was a tremendously in an extraordinary time in American history. You have a terrible Civil War with so many people dead. The South was in ruins, and the country was divided, and you have the first ever presidential assassination. So everyone was very hopeful because Johnson had seemed to be on the same page as many people who said, you know, that traitors, meaning the Southern Confederates, should be punished, basically. But as soon as he came into office, things began to change, and he really did, as you say, stand in opposition to even citizenship, and we're not talking full political rights, but citizenship for the formerly enslaved people, and that's 4 million people. And furthermore, he wanted the South, the 11 seceded states, to come right back into the Union as if nothing had happened. And without citizenship or political rights for those 4 million people, then the South, the white South, is overly represented in the House again.
We'll get to that in a minute, but how bald-faced was the bigotry of Andrew Johnson? How plainly did he express what he was feeling?
Pretty plainly. He's said, and I think probably more than once, that it's reportedly said that this is a country for white men, and by God, it shall be a government for white men. And that sounds dreadful to us. But the interesting thing is that it was dreadful in the middle of the 19th century, too. It's terrible.
Did Johnson's tune change? I mean, did he sound like he was going to be more like Lincoln soon after Lincoln's death, and then did that just sort of come off over time?
Yeah, and it didn't take too much time, actually. But he did sound like Lincoln because, as I said, it was a tumultuous time. You have an assassination. And, but what was remarkable and kind of soothing and consoling to everyone was that the transfer of power was very easy. Johnson took the oath of office, the oath of presidential office, within hours of Lincoln's death. And he said he would keep Lincoln's cabinet. So everyone thought, okay, we're going to go, sort of in the direction that Lincoln seemed to suggest. Nobody really knows what Lincoln would have done, of course.
Right. Well, we'll talk more about the cabinet and how it became central to the anger over Andrew Johnson that led to his impeachment. The book is called The Impeachers, The Trial of Andrew Johnson and the Dream of a Just Nation. Back with Brenda Wineapple in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Our guest this hour is historian and author Brenda Wineapple, who wrote a book called The Impeachers. It is not about our time in history, but it is about 1868 when Andrew Johnson went on trial before the Senate and by one vote managed to hold onto the office of the presidency. The book is subtitled The Trial of Andrew Johnson and the Dream of a Just Nation. It did not feel just to many people in the 1860s, in the latter days after the Civil War. We'll talk about why in just a moment. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. Brenda, I get the sense early in the book that nobody had a really good plan for peace when it came.
Yeah, that's really true. Everyone assumed Lincoln was going to stay in office, and Lincoln himself, thinking about the end of the war, said that even his plans for Reconstruction were provisional. And of course, there was a group of Republicans that were more, we call them today progressive, but they were more radical than Lincoln, and they wanted certainly to give, black men the vote right away. Lincoln was a little bit hesitant. So you're absolutely right. There was nothing sort of ready to go.
So we talked about Andrew Johnson retaining the cabinet of Abraham Lincoln upon assassination and Johnson taking office. So how did Edwin Stanton, the Secretary of War, become the focal point for much of the enmity over Reconstruction?
Well, what was interesting is, Lincoln, Johnson vetoed civil rights legislation, which would have given, black people in the South, full citizenship. The Congress overrode his veto, but Andrew Johnson was vetoing right and left this kind of legislation. He was actually campaigning against the 14th Amendment, which was Congress's way of enshrining, due process and citizenship for all people in the United States. And so what they finally had to do is pass Reconstruction laws that gave Southern black men the vote. But there was a tremendous amount of violence by this time, 1866, 1867, in the South, particularly against both black people and what were called white loyalists or white Republicans, people who have been loyal or were loyal to the Union. And so these Reconstruction laws sent the military or kept the military in the South in order to protect the polls and to protect the black, you know, population and the white loyalists. Edwin Stanton in the cabinet was Secretary of War, and he was in charge more or less of the military and had become more and more radicalized. It certainly stood up for civil rights, even political rights for blacks. He was horrified by the violence in the South, and he wanted to protect the military, which was protecting people, as I said, at the polls, and in the cities and villages and in the countryside. What Johnson did was fire Edwin Stanton when the Senate was in recess. He wasn't supposed to do that because Congress also had passed something called the Tenure of Office Act, which was passed primarily to protect Edwin Stanton. And what it said was that civil officers who had their jobs because of the advice and consent of the Senate, in other words, the Senate had had vote to confirm them, couldn't be fired without the Senate's confirmation, too.
Did the Senate, in essence, or did Congress set up a trap for Johnson, knowing that he wanted to get rid of Stanton?
Well, you know, that's how I think we've come to think of this, that this was a trap to ensnare Johnson. But actually, it wasn't. It was more to protect Edwin Stanton. I don't think Congress thought that Johnson would actually go so far as to violate a law. I mean, that's pretty extreme. And once you do that, you're really flying in the face of Congress. You're saying, I don't care about your laws, and I don't like it. I don't think it's constitutional, so I'm going to break it. That's outrageous when you think about it.
So we were talking about the horrible things that were happening to former slaves in the South. I mean, of course, this is the period that eventually gave rise to the Ku Klux Klan because white people felt like the only way to preserve supremacy if they didn't have control of the government was to go renegade outside of it. It seems like Johnson saw these reports of atrocities in the South and basically disregarded them as fake news.
Yes. He said they were propaganda. That's the word we use today. And it was, you know, largely dismissed on the news that was coming in through newspapers, through firsthand reporters, you know, through journalists who were in the South, through the people themselves, and basically saying, no, these are, you know, an isolated incident. But there were huge massacres in places like New Orleans and Memphis. And in New Orleans, it wasn't just sort of the Ku Klux Klan who felt perhaps the, you know, white population was being disfranchised. It was actually the police and the state legislatures who were ex-Confederates. Even the mayor of New Orleans had been a Confederate. It's amazing, really.
And this is was that the same situation with attacks in New Orleans that General Longstreet, a former Confederate officer, rose to protect?
Yes.
Okay. So was there really any place that authorities were defending the rights of black people, the official authorities?
Well, you mean in the South?
Yes.
I mean, certainly they were in Congress, and I think they were trying to do that in the South, but it was so difficult. As I say, that's why Congress passed these Reconstruction laws, to make sure that people were protected. I mean, there were a number of, you know, to be fair, you know, certainly black activists and whites who were trying to wrest control from Johnson-placed governments, but it was very, very difficult.
Brenda Wineapple is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is The Impeachers, The Trial of Andrew Johnson and the Dream of a Just Nation. So this is ultimately Andrew Johnson versus Congress, and there's a major surprise here. The Congress elected in 1864 did not convene until when, Brenda?
Well, when Lincoln was assassinated in April of 1865, Congress didn't convene again until December, which is a huge amount of time for the executive to really have full control of, you know, the country. And the country was just kind of lurching back into peacetime. Members of Congress went to Johnson and said, why don't you call a special session? And he didn't want to do that. So he had, you know, quite a number of months, you know, more than 6 months.
So that gave him a chance to appoint authorities in the southern states who would respond to him. Okay, outside.
And also to pardon former Confederates because, you know, the terms of getting back into Congress were loose. Johnson overrode Congress in the sense Congress is supposed to determine the qualifications of its own members. And Johnson, who was pardoning as many as 100 people a day, the South was sending these former secessionists back up to Congress to take seats. And, you know, in the House, they weren't allowed, or the Senate, they weren't allowed to do that.
Which gets to a really interesting standoff on terminology and views of the law, that in Johnson's view, since secession was illegal, these states never left the Union, therefore they didn't have to be readmitted.
I know, it's really amazing. I mean, I shouldn't laugh, it's not funny, because he really believes that, and perhaps others did, but people... You know, congressional leaders like, you know, a man named Thaddeus Stevens, who, you know, said that's like saying murder is against the law and therefore this killing didn't happen. You know, it seemed illogical, but that was his point of view. So he was just welcoming these 11 states back as if they had never waged war against the Union.
Oh, and so, but yeah, that, and you mentioned he was pardoning officials and stuff. So nobody who actually had served in the Confederacy in Johnson's mind was suspect.
Right. And they, you know, and prior to his becoming president, he said they were all suspect. But suddenly he had his power and he was allowing people who, you know, ironically had no use for him, the planter class, but he was allowing them to come back into government and, into legislatures, state legislatures, you know, which was terrifying, I think, for the people in the states.
You mentioned one congressional leader, Thaddeus Stevens of Pennsylvania in the House,
right.
Charles Sumner of Massachusetts in the Senate, the name might ring a bell if you remember that he was nearly beaten to death by a Southerner on the floor of Congress years before.
Yes, he was. I mean, with an inch of his life, while you know, people stood around and egged the person who was beating him with a cane, egged him on, he recovered and he came back, and he was as outspoken and as firm in his championing of equal rights for all as ever. So he was an important leader in the House. As you mentioned, Thaddeus Stevens was an important leader in Sumner was in the Senate and Stevens in the House. And, you know, Sumner has a very good, you know, his reputation remained intact. Somebody like Stevens, you know, fell off the radar pretty much because he was considered so radical. He was kind of portrayed in Chris's Birth of a Nation, which was fictionalized, but the portrait of Thaddeus Stevens as a, you know, diabolical maniac.
Although he was portrayed better, as you point out, in the movie Lincoln with Tommy Lee Jones portraying Thaddeus Stevens.
Right, somewhat better, that's right.
Brenda Wineapple, historian and author, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is called The Impeachers, The Trial of Andrew Johnson and the Dream of a Just Nation. She takes us back to the 1860s for this book with certain parallels to our time. 800-838-3760 if you'd like to join the conversation by phone. Our email box is open as well at jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Valentine in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yes, hello. My name is Valentine Jones, and the family lore on my mother's side is that, well, I am a descendant of Judge T.A.R. Nelson, who I understand was Johnson's counsel during his impeachment. And I just wanted to check on whether or not the author had run across his name.
Oh, yes. Thanks for your call. That's so interesting that you are... a descendant of Judge Nelson. In fact, he plays an interesting role in the defense of Andrew Johnson. He's very much in the book. He was, originally he wasn't really a fan of Johnson, but he came to defend him very, very strongly during the trial.
Thanks for the call, Valentine. Appreciate hearing of your connection there. So to reset the stage here, we have Andrew Johnson, through his executive powers, approaching the restoration of the Union after the Civil War in one way. The Republicans in Congress, who had control of both houses, attempting to go about it a very different way, vetoes left and right. So a lot of anger in Washington, a lot of action against African Americans in the South as they attempted to exercise what should have been their newfound rights. It sounds like a mix of moods in the country outside the South. Was there any clear feeling that you get from that time about how people felt about what was going on?
Well, it's really hard to know, you know. But in terms of the really national newspapers I read, they were, you know, they were as partisanly divided as is. You know, papers are today, certainly. But the interesting thing is that Andrew Johnson began to alienate people who were even in his own party. And he really, after a certain point, stood alone, even though, of course, as we know, he was not convicted, as you mentioned earlier, and he finished out his term. But nonetheless, he had been so obstinate that even people who supported him, you know, and basically would say to him, why don't you just, you know, support the 14th Amendment, then you'll pacify the people who hate you, you'll heal the country, and he wouldn't do it. As I said, the 14th Amendment grants due process. It doesn't even give political rights. But so he was intransigent, stubborn.
So you touched on this already, and I want to get into it in fuller detail now. You pointed out that whether African Americans could vote or not in the South, removing them from the list of slaves and turning them into regular people increased the political power of the South. How?
Yeah, well, remember the Constitution said that the formerly enslaved were 3/5 of a person. That's how they were counted, you know, for the Electoral College and in terms of representation. As soon as you pass the 13th Amendment, you're counting those people, 4 million people, as full persons, which changes, of course, the count in the South in terms of representation. So those people, if they can't vote, are being represented by a population with which they have really nothing to do and who had previously held them as chattel. It's really remarkable.
It really is. So they're being denied the rights of citizenship, but then we're at least being counted as citizens in the census data that would provide, obviously, more members of the House of Representatives for
exactly.
the southern states.
That's exactly how it went.
The book, I should point out, is illustrated, and it includes a Thomas Nast cartoon showing King Andy smiling while African Americans are killed. Is there any reliable count of how vast the slaughter got in the Reconstruction days?
Yeah, there really are reliable accounts because, first of all, people like General Phil Sheridan, who was outside of, say, New Orleans when you know what he called the massacre occurred, came back and he really saw corpses on the streets. He was horrified by what he saw, and he was no radical, you know, as we know from history and his later, you know, point of view about Native Americans. Furthermore, Congress sent a committee down to various places in the South, particularly Memphis and New Orleans, as I mentioned, to investigate. And though investigations and firsthand reports are available in the congressional records that they kept at the time. So, yeah, we get a very close look at what happened. And then, of course, there are letters and diaries that represent what happened. And Thomas Nast, as you mentioned, you know, was one of those people in very popular, you know, caricaturist who was horrified and did a series of kind of anti-Johnson, anti-white supremacist cartoons in Harper's Weekly.
So let's go through a timeline again. So Civil War ends. A month later, Abraham Lincoln is assassinated. Andrew Johnson becomes president and basically has free reign for 8 months before Congress finally convenes. So that takes us to the end of 1865. The actual trial, the impeachment and trial, wasn't until 1868. There were congressional elections amidst the chaos in 1866.
Right.
And Andrew Johnson did a road show. Tell us about that.
Well, first of all, those first congressional elections in 1866 went heavily for the Republicans. So it's interesting. They had majorities in Congress. But the road show that you're talking about, excuse me, is really rather remarkable because Johnson is basically campaigning and holding rallies for himself against Congress when he would say people like Thaddeus Stevens or Charles Sumner should be executed, which is, you know, horrific. And also, as I said, he's campaigning against the 14th Amendment, and he's basically saying that the 14th Amendment will, you know, inaugurate the rule of what he called Negro supremacy. So he was really kind of pumping up the crowds against these kinds of, you know, sort of very moderate changes in the government. And it was horrifying to many people. And again, Thomas Nast lampooned it, and so did many others. People thought he must be drunk to be going on the way he was.
Was he drunk? Is there
no, I don't think so. I think that would have been a good excuse for him. I mean, he did drink. There's no doubt about it, but we wouldn't call him by today's terms an alcoholic. But he acted because he was in such a frenzy and because he had known to be drunk at his vice presidential inauguration. People thought maybe that would be, you know, a way we could understand or rationalize this really frenetic behavior, crazy behavior.
Yeah, truly some odd behavior on this this roadshow before the 1866 congressional elections, which he influenced in reverse, really. He got the opposite of what he wanted. And then within 2 years was on trial for removal from office in the Senate. The book is called The Impeachers, The Trial of Andrew Johnson and the Dream of a Just Nation. Back with Brenda Wineapple on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest is Brenda Wineapple, historian and author. She's written a new book about Andrew Johnson and his impeachment trial in the U.S. Senate in 1868. He survived by one vote to finish out his presidency. The book is called The Impeachers, The Trial of Andrew Johnson and the Dream of a Just Nation. You can join the conversation on the program if you have questions, comments, things to add to the conversation about post-Civil War America and how weird things got. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I want to come back, Brenda, to a term you talked about earlier, because we haven't talked about it much, the idea of radical Republicans. These are the people who really wanted to assert power or voting rights, or citizenship rate, basically, for freed slaves in the South. So who labeled them radical?
I think they were labeled earlier on, before even, you know, the Johnson administration. They were considered radical during the war, actually, and they were the ones who pushed Lincoln toward, you know, abolition, because originally the war had been fought, at least on paper, to save the Union, not to free the slaves. So they were, you know, they were called black Republicans as a way of deriding them, and then radical Republicans as a way of making them very scary. And then, of course, that name stuck after the war.
So here the stage is set that we have the radical Republicans in firmer control of Congress after the elections of 1866. And how long after the new Congress took power did it begin a serious focus on impeachment?
Very soon after. What was interesting is, you know, as you said, the actual impeachment takes place in early and in the spring of 1868. But as soon as the new Congress took its seat in, you know, in December and then January of 1867, some of the more sort of hot-headed, I would say, radicals started pushing for impeachment. A man named James Ashley called for impeachment right away. But impeachment's hard to do, and you know, people don't want to do it. It seems so terrifying, and it had never been done before. So what happened was that the Judiciary Committee, and we've all heard of that, began an investigation of Johnson before it would bring, you know, sort of an impeachment vote up in the full House. So the Judiciary Committee, you know, looked into everything Johnson had done, you know, basically looking for a smoking gun, looking for something that was very kind of concrete, a law that he had violated. And there really wasn't any, but his, you know, so it voted against impeachment. But then his behavior and his abuse of power and his, you know, sort of insult to Congress and all of that, the Judiciary Committee changed its mind, voted for impeachment, but then the full House didn't vote, didn't go along with it. So it wasn't really until, as I mentioned, he violated this Tenure of Office Act that Congress then stood up and said, that's it, we've had enough.
I want to get outside Congress for just a bit to bring in some other names and perspectives here. Frederick Douglass, of course, a prominent abolitionist and African-American. How did he express views of Andrew Johnson, if any, and did Johnson have any prominent supporters?
Well, Frederick Douglass was considered a radical Republican, and Frederick Douglass, very early on, was very, very critical of Johnson and his policies and basically said that, you know, Johnson was continuing the attitudes of slavery, you know, and perpetuating the lingering and pernicious effects of slavery. So he was very, very adamantly opposed to Johnson and had gone in to see Johnson early on with a group of, you know, black people, and Johnson basically was, from our point of view, you know, in their point of view, condescending. And as soon as they left, you know, he was insulting to them. So he wasn't going to listen to anyone. But, you know, Douglass really has remained with us as, you know, an insightful and visionary figure.
Was there anybody in the North, anybody outside the South who had any use for Andrew Johnson?
Well, you know, I think the Democrats for a while were using him, but, you know, as I said, he alienated them too. He thought, they thought that he, Johnson, should have fired people like Stanton, Secretary of War, and even William Seward, who is another, you know, leftover from Lincoln's administration, Secretary of State, right away. And so, you know, he wasn't following their program, even though they were white supremacists, any more than he was following the Republican program, and not just the radicals. The moderate Republicans had been alienated by him. And in a certain sense, you know, what people said is that Johnson managed to unify all aspects of the Republican Party because, you know, some of them, they didn't all agree with one another.
So did hatred of Johnson lead to some people switching positions or new alliances forming?
Well, yeah, in a sense, you know, as soon as he violated that Tenure of Office Act, you know, the moderates joined forces with the radicals, and that's why they voted overwhelmingly to impeach, because, you know, finally they had had enough, and they had been trying to conciliate and work with him and get legislation passed, and every time he seemed to be agreeing, then he would turn around and stab them in the back. So they really had enough.
Let me back up a step. Before the full House got to that point, there was that initial referral you talked about where the Judiciary Committee referred the articles of impeachment to the full House. The full House voted no. They didn't want to take it up.
Right.
Was it at this point that that Johnson sent a message back to Congress in response to that referral?
Well, he was sending quite a number of messages back to Congress, and certainly, you know, when he did what we call today the State of the Union, they were so abusive of Congress. He was basically saying Congress wasn't legitimate. You know, I mean, what a thing to say, and because if it wasn't legitimate, then even the 13th Amendment wasn't legitimate. And what he meant by that is that if you don't have the 11 seceded states sitting in Congress, then you don't have a full Congress. And so he said, you know, this is a Congress on the verge of a government. And so he was basically ignoring them. It's really kind of stunning.
Yeah, well, we've been so polite so far, but the fact is that you can't miss some of the parallels with the behavior of Donald Trump toward other branches of government.
It's interesting because I started the book 6 years ago. There wasn't a Donald Trump on the, you know, certainly not on the on the Washington horizon. And lo and behold, by the time I finished it, it's a whole different thing. But the parallels, you know, are stunning in terms of, you know, to put it again, to be polite, the contest between the executive and the legislative branches of Congress, you know, and that there really is a question of the balance of power and, as I said before, abuse of power and, as well, demagoguery, rallying, you know, a certain kind of support in a kind of almost, you know, frenetic way.
There's a name key to the 1860s we haven't mentioned yet, and that's the name of Ulysses Grant. And how did he figure in Johnson's attempt to remove Edwin Stanton as the Secretary of War?
Well, what Johnson tried to do was, you know, replace Stanton with Grant and use Grant. And Grant realized that he was being used. He had become more radicalized. Nobody really knew what, you know, Grant's politics were, especially when he was a general. People were concerned about his being a general. But Grant had been forced to go on that, you know, stump tour that we talked about. It was called Swing Around the Circle when Johnson was so abusive and seemingly so drunk. And what Grant did was himself get, you know, go on a bender, and they had to put him in a baggage car and sleep it off because he said it was such a national disgrace he couldn't even deal with it. So Johnson tried to use Grant to replace Stanton, and Grant realized, I'm not getting involved in this. I'm not going to violate the Tenure of Office Act, and I'm not going to betray the soldiers that I've worked with who are now stationed in the South and that Johnson's firing. So he pushed back very strongly against Andrew Johnson. And, of course, Grant was then, by then, thinking of himself being president.
You had a which he was, with the election of 1868.
Right.
We'll get to that in a moment. You mentioned Mark Twain earlier. He is woven throughout the story, and he covered some of this. I mean, how influential was he on this, and did he ever get beyond the point of thinking that it was all just silly people doing silly things?
Well, it wasn't so much silly people doing silly things, but I think he became so disgusted. He was a satirist from way back, you know, so we could think of Huck Finn as being satirical, but as a novel, he was actually a wonderful political commentator, and he would be sitting in Congress, and he was obviously, to my mind, very, very, you know, taken with the radical Republicans, particularly Stevens. But at a certain point, he just left Washington, and, you know, in disgust, really, with politicians, but very sympathetic to the radicals. He had thought, it's clear, he had thought that they should be impeaching Johnson even earlier than they had.
So obviously lots of opportunities to stay up with the news. This is a time when towns big and small had multiple newspapers, but certainly before broadcast media and also before opinion polling the way we've come to know it now. Do we get a sense of what the general American public was thinking of all that was going on in Washington?
Well, at a certain point, I think everybody was against Johnson, but as the trial went on, and it didn't go on that long, but it seemed long. It's, you know, he was impeached in February. The trial starts in March. It's more or less over in May, pretty much at the same time as the national conventions are starting to take place for the election. So I think the people at a certain point tuned out, you know, that the trial was being covered, that legal arguments were being made pro and con, that there was a lot of legalese, and it wasn't lightning bolts coming down. It was really a kind of, very interestingly enough, orderly procedure that when the trial finally took place.
And as we pointed out, by one vote, Johnson reached the end of his term in office. He got to serve until March 4th of 1869, when Grant took over, having won the election of 1868. In later years, Brenda, did the participants in any of this think any differently of the whole episode?
Yeah, they wanted to distance themselves from it, you know, and they began to think, oh, the radicals had been hysterical, we were hysterical, it was a mistake. And, you know, what was interesting about that point of view is that point of view sort of coincides with the rise of Jim Crow. And what, to my mind, got buried about this whole impeachment process was the fact that what stimulated it was really racism, Johnson's racism, and his willingness to, you know, abolish slavery but sort of keep an entire people really enslaved by other means, black codes, you know, lack of citizenship, lack of due process, all of that. So in that sense, the rise of Jim Crow, the fact that the impeachment was associated with racism and slavery, that all became buried, and many, many people who are still alive, you know, like Representative James Blaine, who then later ran for president, basically said, we made a mistake, we shouldn't have done it, it was, you know, we're embarrassed.
And we, all the things you mentioned, Jim Crow laws, poll taxes, literacy,
exactly.
It went on for another 100 years.
That's exactly right. You know, and I think that the point of view about the impeachment, insofar as it was looked at, because it was still sort of not looked at as kind of embarrassing, you know, anecdote in American history, but it began to change sort of in the 1960s, when civil rights legislation is not just being passed, but people are beginning to, you know, look at that period of Reconstruction in a very different way than it had been looked at, say, from the vantage point of Birth of a Nation.
Well, we mentioned that Ulysses S. Grant became president in the next election, 1868, and one of the worst in the opinions of historians. But Andrew Johnson himself had a second act in politics, which a lot of people might not know about. What was that, Brenda?
He came back to the Senate. And interestingly enough, you know, this was during the period when the state legislature chose its senators. They weren't popularly elected. And Tennessee sent Andrew Johnson back to the Senate. In 1875, Grant was still president. Johnson hated Grant. Grant hated Johnson. But the times were changing. Even though Grant had gotten rid of the Ku Klux Klan, the Republicans got much more moderate, and many people, Democrats, you know, especially, welcomed Johnson back into office. He didn't stay very long because he, you know, passed away. But it's a rather sort of grim turn of events in a certain sense. But his presidency, you know, to go back to that, his presidency is certainly, you know, a shameful one, and it was even considered that then. Impeachment maybe was something people didn't want to think about anymore, but shameful was Johnson.
There's just so much to take in the book, including the Thaddeus Stevens. Where was he buried?
Oh, he's buried in Pennsylvania, Lancaster, Pennsylvania. You know, he represented Pennsylvania, and he's buried in an integrated cemetery because he refused to be buried. He refused to be buried in a segregated one. When he found out that his plot was in a segregated one, he immediately sold it.
Wow, that's an amazing story. So many amazing things in the book: The Impeachers, The Trial of Andrew Johnson, and The Dream of a Just Nation. Brenda Wineapple wrote it. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.
All right, take care. That'll do it for today's Exchange. We're online at jeffexchange.org. Our producer is John Baxter and April Ehrlich. Student assistant Randy Babbitt at the controls today. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Please join us next time and have a great day. Banned pesticides begin Thursday's Jefferson Exchange. We'll talk about why this country bans fewer than other countries. Later in Hour 1, Underground History serves up some beer. Yes, we'll meet a beer archaeologist. In Hour 2, Languages Change, we revisit the author of Words on the Move. That's on Thursday's Jefferson Exchange. This morning's program airs again from 8 to 10 this evening on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio.
Welcome to As It Was, Tales from the Mythical State of Jefferson. In the 1970s, historian Kay Atwood of Ashland, Oregon, spent 3 years getting to know the people born in one of the most isolated regions in southern Oregon. In 1978, she told their story in the book titled Illahee, The Story of Settlement in the Rogue River Canyon. Atwood wrote, "The major portion of this 40-mile stretch, the lower Rogue River and surrounding country, is accessible only by trail, water, and a few unimproved roads. The canyon remains an uninhabited, wild place." Atwood discovered that simple family trees became tangled webs of relationships and intermarriage, complicated by a limited number of potential marriage partners. For example, two early settlers accounted for 8 wives and 30 children. Atwood wrote, "The world of the Rogue River from Agnes to Grave Creek is different now, carved apart by logging roads, the silence broken by powerboats and airplanes, seasonal fishermen, hunters, and backpackers. Much of the land is managed by federal agencies. Almost no one has chosen to share the placer miner's heritage." Upon her death in May 2014, regional historian George Kramer said, "It's hard to write about Southern Oregon without citing Kay Atwood." Today's episode of As It was written by Kernan Turner and produced by Raymond Scully. I'm Shirley Patton. To share stories or to learn more about the series, visit asitwas.org.